Well, it's past our time to begin. This morning I'd like to just give a brief survey of the many centuries that preceded the China of today. What happens in China under communism may not be so different from what has been true in China before. With a history as long as that of China, we will find that there are periods in Chinese history that are quite similar to what's been happening under Mao. And that there are those who think that in some respects Mao has been trying to go back into Chinese history and to recreate some of the periods that have preceded him. Not, of course, that anything can be similar altogether, but there are great fundamental changes in the society of China which do find a certain precedence in the earlier periods. I've listed on the board the main periods of Chinese history. I'm not going to spend much time with them, but just as we divide European history into the periods of monarchies, or the history of the United States into the periods of presidencies, so back in ancient times, for instance, Babylon and Egypt, they measured time by the dynasties. A dynasty would be not only the rule of one king, but a group of kings related to him, or a part of the administration of that kingdom, and it would run over centuries in some cases. These are the main dynasties in China, and you often find reference to them as a sort of a ready reference to a period in Chinese history. There are about 25 dynasties altogether in China, and they cover a period of over 2,000 years. So a lot of things have happened in those two millennia. But the first of the dynasties that we want to speak about briefly, because it laid the foundation of Chinese history, was the Qin Han dynasty. There are those who think that the name China itself comes from this early dynasty of Qin. But the Qin and the Han, you notice, would cover the period about the time of the birth of Christ, from about 200 years before Christ to 200 years after Christ. And it's generally admitted that this is one of the most important periods in all of Chinese history, because what happened then lived on so long throughout all of the following centuries. And we'll speak about some of those fundamental things. Then another important period is that of the Sixth Dynasty. They didn't last very long, each of them, but certain very important things happened in the period 221 to 589 AD, which of course corresponds to our early Middle Ages in Europe, when the Vandals and the Goths and the tribes from the north were trying to overturn the Roman Empire. Here you have the old civilization already in China, and things happened that didn't happen in the West until many, many centuries later. Another important dynasty that is the Sui, 589 and 618, the Tang Dynasty, 618 to 907, the Sung Dynasty, 960 to 1279. You'll find references to these names in art, for instance. A period of Chinese art would be referred to the Tang Dynasty, the Sung Dynasty, or later the Ming Dynasty, because it's during that period that these developments occurred. Then there's a very important and very unusual period, 1279 to 1318, when the Chinese were ruled by the Mongols, and it's the Mongolian Empire that is really in control of all of China. It only lasted for less than 100 years, but the very spectacular events took place in the early 3rd century. Then the Ming Dynasty, which occurred about the time of the Reformation in Europe, and 1368 to 1644, we find more of the modern China, and then one of the longest of all, the Manchu Dynasty, which started in 1644, about the time the pilgrims came over here to this country, and lasted to 1912, so that the end of the dynasties in China has taken place in our own century. It was in 1912 that the last of the Manchu emperors, in this case an empress dowager, was abdicated and brought to an end the old China. What we speak of the Republic of China starts in 1912, and you have a period from 1912 to 1949 when China is trying to decide which way it's going to go, and in 1949 Mao takes complete control and the China becomes communist. Well, this is just a sort of a framework on which we can hang some of the history of China, and events that we refer to will fit in one place or another here. The Qin and the Han dynasties were a period of expansion, and I'm not going to go into each of the periods as to what happened. In fact, we might summarize by saying that all through this period, there was a certain ebb and flow in China. The beginnings of China were up here, as we mentioned yesterday, in the Yellow River valleys, between the Yangtze and the Yellow River, in the very eastern part. China was originally what they called Han China, H-A-N. Was this region around here that would now be called North China. And what happens throughout all of these dynasties is the attempt of this smaller China to expand, to defend itself against the enemies on the outside. And you have periods when the Chinese Empire contracts, when the border enemies are victorious, or you have periods of expansion when China expands in all directions and becomes a much greater country. You could trace the whole history of China in regard to this. How are they able to deal with their enemies on the borders? I mentioned yesterday that you have today the opposition between China and Russia. Well, that goes way back thousands of years when China here was fighting against the people to the north, the Manchurians or the Mongols. This whole part is called Outer or Inner Mongolia. And there's constant warfare between China and Mongolia. Today, Mongolia is a part of the Chinese Empire. But there have been times when the Mongols have been victorious over the Chinese and driven them back. Then too, there have been periods when Chinese have tried to expand westward. They've gone back into the mountains here and tried to conquer the peoples here in the deserts or mountains or in the forests, partly to defend themselves against the forays of these people going into China. The Great Wall runs around here, 2,000 miles, and built by emperors who thought that if they built this Great Wall, they could keep the enemies out. And they did. But it'd be like building a wall almost between the Canadian and the United States border. Today it wouldn't mean much, but in those days it was a fortification against the enemies to the north. Then there are periods when the Chinese start moving southward and southwestward, and China expands to include much more of southern China, and even down here into what we call Southeast Asia, so that there were times when China felt that it controlled North Vietnam and South Vietnam and what we today call Laos and Cambodia. It was under the influence of China. And then over here in the high Tibet region, there was warfare between the tribes of northern India and the Tibetans. And there are some interesting events when armies from China are way over here in touch with the legions that came from the Eastern Roman Empire. It's a fascinating reading, nearly 1,000 years ago, when the meeting of the East and the West, usually in the mountains or in the deserts, trying to decide who was going to control it. One of the reasons why they wanted to control it was to control the trade routes, because there was constant trade going on between the East and the West. And whoever controlled the trade route was able to safeguard the passage of merchandise from East to West. Much of this is desert. There isn't so much of Chinese history up here, but a great deal down this way and a great deal up that way. Well, so much for what the warfare in these various dynasties is concerned. What we are more concerned about is how did China develop into the kind of a nation that it is. For you have these hundreds of millions of people, and what did they believe? How were they governed? What kind of life did they live? The name of the philosopher who probably more than anyone else influenced all Chinese history was Confucius. And Confucius goes way back to this period. His years were 551 BC to 479 BC, 500 years before Christ. That in itself is an interesting event or fact. Here you have a philosopher about the time of the Babylonian captivity, about the time of the Old Testament, in a part of the world where there is no influence at all of the Moses or of the Old Testament. One of the things that makes China so interesting to me is the opportunity of studying a great people that is so different from any Christian people. It helps you, I think, to analyze Christianity better. What is it that we believe? When you compare it with a people and a culture that never had any contact with the revelation of God. We don't often stop, I think, to think about this. We sort of take for granted that the Old Testament, Moses and the prophets, were known to all mankind. That's not true. Actually, they were known to a very small part of mankind. And the history of Israel in the Old and even in the New Testament touches one particular people, the people of Israel, until gradually it expands to become a world power. But in China, you have a people that have no religion in the sense that we have a religion from that time. Confucius is called the founder of a great religion, but it's a question whether you can call him religious. He didn't believe in anything supernatural. There is no afterlife. There is no other world. The only world is this world, this life. He speaks little or not at all of gods. He does speak of gods because there were people that believed in certain kinds of gods, as in practically all cultures. He believed in the development of a system of thought that was based on how men behaved toward each other. It would be more correct, I think, to speak of Confucius as a philosopher and a teacher of ethics than as a religion, a teacher of religion. And that has some interesting aspects today, when so much of our own culture is losing touch of revelation and coming down to the level of a secular life. You meet this kind of a culture which Confucius 2,000 years ago took for granted was the kind of life. And I find a lot of resemblance between secular philosophy today and the ethics and behavior of the people in our modern life and what Confucius was talking about and what he believed. He thought that the most important thing was to have a stable government. If this is the only life, then how you get along in this life is the most important thing. And to have a government that kept people in their place, so that each one knew his place and did his work. There's a certain hierarchy of values. It's a system that encompasses all of life, but it centers in the control of the masses by an intellectual class. Probably the most marked example of what it led to was the examination system, which grew to be the classical form of life in China, where you have a class of people who become educated. Well, they enter into school through various stiff examinations. And these examinations, it takes the best of the young people to prepare for, and takes them a long time to prepare. You might compare it with our civil service examination, only there's no resemblance to content. The examination was based on the history and culture and literature of China. Confucius dreamt of a golden age when things were perfect in China, and he wanted to restore this vision of an orderly people where each one did his part in the life of the community. And the classics that they assembled became a sort of a five-foot shelf of learning, which was the standard learning of China. You took these examinations, and if you passed them, you entered into the bureaucracy. You became a member of the government, of the ruling class. And the intellectuals who were the successful people in the examinations became the intellectual leaders of China. So that you have built up a great system of schools, which are limited, of course, in their content, but which have as their purpose the finding of the brightest and best and most obedient of the young men, who in turn become then the bureaucrats and the rulers of the people. It's a type of government that took hundreds and hundreds of years to develop, but it was started back there in the Qin and the Han dynasties. Suppose I read just a few sentences from Confucius. We could spend the whole hour on Confucius. We may sometime during the month. But just to give you a sample of what kind of things were being taught, I'm reading from the Analects of Confucius. There were four things that Confucius was determined to eradicate: a biased mind, arbitrary judgments, obstinacy, and egotism. In education, there are no class distinctions, in the sense that any youth could take the examinations course, what kind of a background he had would probably determine whether he passed or not, but at least it was open to him. Just as in the Middle Ages in Europe, about the only way a poor boy could get into the professional class was to go into the ministry. The church offered freedom to any young man to study for the ministry, and in that way he got out of the lower class to the upper. When you know a thing, say that you know it. When you do not know a thing, admit that you do not know it. That is knowledge, which isn't a bad motto. Tzu King asked, is there any one word that can serve as a principle for the conduct of life? Confucius said, perhaps the word reciprocity. Do not do to others what you would not want others to do to you. Now this is 400 years before Christ, so that what we call the golden rule is already in the words of Confucius, part of the thought of the Chinese people. To be able to practice five virtues everywhere in the world constitutes humanity. And these are the five virtues: courtesy, magnanimity, good faith, diligence, and kindness. Fan Chi asked Confucius about humanity. Confucius said, love men. It is a little startling, is it not, to find phrases that we have thought were only Christian in the mouths of a heathen philosopher 400 or 500 years before the New Testament. Well, that shouldn't disturb us. God's truth isn't restricted only to one people or one kind of people. But in this case, these virtues are virtues of humanity, virtues in the social life of the people, where he learns to live with others outside. I read again, a young man's duty is to be filial to his parents at home and respectful to his elders abroad, to be circumspect and truthful, and while overflowing with love for all men, to associate himself with humanity. A word which Confucius uses, yen, which is a central word in his teaching. Those who know the truth are not up to those who love it. Those who love the truth are not up to those who delight in it. Well, these are all from the sayings of the Confucius. We don't know yet about life. How can we know about death? We don't know yet how to serve men. How can we know about serving the spirits? Look at heaven there. Does it speak? The four seasons run their course, and all things are produced. Does heaven speak? There's an atheism here, agnosticism certainly. Forget about spirits. Forget about heaven. Forget about supernatural things. Concentrate on your relationship to your daily life with your fellow men. And most important is your relationship to those nearest to you. Every Chinese scholar admits that one of the central characteristics in Chinese life used to be the respect that the elders were held in by the youth, the family. Fathers and grandfathers lived with the children of the family unit, and this close relationship between old and young in the family was probably the building block of the whole Chinese society, and that went back to Confucius, who taught that your first duty is to be respectful to those above you, to those around you, to your parents, to your family. The way of the gentleman is threefold. I myself have not been able to attain any of them. Being humane, he has no anxieties. Being wise, he has no perplexities. Being brave,
he has no fear. The gentleman, and to Confucius, the gentleman was the ideal in society. The gentleman understands what is right. The inferior man understands what is profitable. The gentleman seeks to enable people to succeed in what is good, but does not help them in what is evil. The inferior man does the contrary. To govern is to set things right. If you begin by setting yourself right, who will dare to deviate from the right? Lead the people by virtues and restrain them by the rules of decorum, and the people will have a sense of shame and, moreover, will become good. Well, we can't go further into this, but Confucius did have a tremendous influence on the society of China because he went to the leaders, to the rulers, and he tried to teach the rulers what was the way to govern. All through the writings of Confucius, it's this question, how does the ruler govern his people? And Confucius and his disciple were trying to find the way to get good order into the government so that there would be peace and that people would have a correct behavior. In fact, correct behavior, correct conduct is almost the key word to Confucius. In this Han period, the Qin period, then you have the forming of an ideal by rulers and people as to what kind of a life it should be. Not that it happened altogether that way. Human nature is too different. But again, it leads us back to the present. Does Mao, whom some people think likes to think of himself as a modern Confucius, does Mao in his little red book, The Thoughts of Mao, think that he can replace Confucius? Can he form the ideas of a whole nation the way Confucius did? And there are those who find a good deal of resemblance between some of the teachings of Confucius and the teachings of Mao. Actually, what happened in that age and what happened in practically every age is that life was much more selfish. There was much more violence and strife. Confucius was trying to replace feudalism with an orderly government, but he didn't succeed in many instances. And instead in China, you had the development of large landholders who would subject the people to heavy taxation, and they became actually serfs, so that the idea of a conduct, right conduct of the people becomes a sort of a means of teaching the people to be obedient to the ruler and take things as they come, be subject to the authorities that are above you. You could use the teachings of Confucius in that way. And the peasants didn't gain a great deal by it. Rather, they became poorer, they sank deeper into servitude as the years went on. In the period of the Six Dynasties, 221 to 589, there's a good deal of division in the empire. Qin and Han had brought people together and had made the empire larger than it had been before. In the period of the Six Dynasties, it fell apart, and you have regions that become independent of the central government. An interesting phase of this is that when you have that condition in China, you have much more tolerance, so that if it's broken up into various regions, there isn't the same suppression that there is when one ruler tries to govern the whole people. And there was one of the philosophers in China who taught the government to suppress all opposition. One of the leading philosophers who believed that all of human nature was evil. Confucius more or less believed human nature was good. But Mencius taught the people, taught the kings, people are bad, human nature is evil, suppress opposition. And they went so far one while that they burned all of the books of the opposition philosophers. The emperor decided that through the guidance of one of the teachers that all of the books that were opposed to central government that allowed any freedom should be burned. That's a great burning of books. An idea that the Roman Empire or Roman Church later took up, of course, in the Inquisition. But you have way back in China here that to get everybody to obey the government, get rid of all the enemies of the government, get rid of their books, get rid of their ideas, don't let them teach, don't let them speak. You have that kind of a period in Chinese history. But it didn't usually succeed. You'd have a breakup into various factions, and then there was more tolerance. In those periods, you have a greater intercourse with other nations, trade with the South and with the North. And it's in one of those periods that we have another great religion that comes into China, namely Buddhism. Buddhism entered China about the year between 400 and 500, almost 1,000 years and later than Confucius. But it became one of the great religions of China. And here again, we could easily spend the hour on Buddhism, for it is so different from Confucius. And yet you have to set the one against the other to get an idea of how different China reacted. Confucius came out of China. He was a typical Chinese. Buddhism was an importation. It came from India through Burma. Buddhism was then down here in the south, but through the channels of trade, it came up through Burma, mountains, and then up into China, into central China. And in one of these periods, when there was more or less freedom to teach otherwise than the government wanted, Buddhism became was spread among a lot of people. There was a tendency to be interested in it. Here again, it shows that the human spirit isn't satisfied with simply secular philosophy. And Buddhism talked about a spiritual world, about a transcendent world, a world outside of ourselves, an entirely different kind of a world. So it appealed to many Chinese as a means of escaping from the harsh realities of life. Buddhism is a religion, not only a philosophy, and it goes pretty deep into human thought. It's hard to know where to begin or to end on this great subject of Buddhism. It teaches, and there are different types of Buddhism, but there are four noble truths that you'll find in most of Buddhism. All life is sorrowful, is one of them. Life isn't happy. Life is harsh. Life is cruel. All life sorrowful. Second, sorrow is due to craving. Why are we sorrowful? Because we're always desiring something. We desire to get something. We desire to be something. We desire to be somewhere else. We desire to be somebody else. There's a craving for or a desire for something outside of ourselves. The third noble truth is stop craving. If you stop desiring all of these things that lead you to all of the worries and disappointments and griefs of life, then you cut the root of the sadness of life. And four, by disciplined conduct and meditation, you can withdraw from all of these desires of the world into yourself and into something else. All things are composite. Everything in the world is put together. And therefore, there's always change. These component parts don't stop and change from day to day, from year to year, from one period of life to another. It's inherent in the constitution then of nature that there has to be change. There is no abiding thing in the world. And our desire or craving for something that is stable, secure, that won't change, is simply an illusion. The individual then is affected by these changes. Death separates the material and the immaterial. Body and soul, and Buddhism speaks about body and soul. To Confucius, they were one, but Buddhism speaks of spirit and speaks of a body. And the spirit has to be separated from the body. And here is the basis in Buddhism for the idea of transmigration of souls. The soul can go from one body to another. And it does, depending on what you've done in this life, it affects what kind of a body you will enter into after death. An idea that has had far-reaching influence, of course, but the idea that the soul and the body are separate leads to the idea, too, that you should get rid of your body. If you could only let the spirit take full control and stop the desires which the body has, you can stop this chain of rebirth by which you go from one body to another, which simply leads you from one evil to another, from one grief to another, is to enter the state of nirvana. Nirvana is hard to describe exactly what it means. Sometimes you get the idea it means nothingness, that you get absorbed into a spirit of nothingness in which there is no desire. But that isn't quite correct. The meaning of the word nirvana is akin to blowing out of a lamp. You blow out a lamp and the light is gone. You blow out all the desires of life and you enter into a state not of darkness, but of lack of desire. You have come into a absorption of your spirit in a larger all-soul, if you want to call it that, where your own griefs have disappeared. You can see the attraction of that kind of a thing for a people that had very little to be happy about in life, with the rice that they lived on, very little land, hard work. The idea that you could get away from this and get into a state of being where there is no pain. It would be an attraction to a lot of people, and Buddhism did spread among the Chinese. To the more intellectual, it was sort of an intellectual change into
a being where you are no longer the individual. Buddhism claims that life is made up of forms. Forms change. Mountains, forms, plains, rivers, clouds, houses. Everything is made up of forms. If you can lose these forms into the all soul of being, you get away from the pain of change, which is at the heart of so much of our sadness and grief. And nirvana is that state of bliss, probably as good a word as we can find, a blissful, ecstatic experience where we have lost ourselves in something far above ourselves. One of the aspects of this you hear a good deal about today in meditation. There's an attraction of Buddhism to young people. There are in this country today some of these yogis or teachers who are telling our people and our young people to forget to these things, material things of the world, and center on the spiritual things. Lose yourself in meditation. This thing branches off into all kinds of things, of course, but the idea of meditation or reflection is that you get away from the little pricks and pains of daily experience and lose yourself in something bigger, something more fundamental, something more universal. And you immediately think of its relationship to Christianity. Here again, we could spend time on, is there something here that is equally true to us? This love for meditation is to sort of collect ourselves. We go to pieces. And recollection is a collecting of the pieces and making it a whole again, which certainly we need in an age where we're driven from one thing to another. We're like leaves blown by the autumn winds. We don't control ourselves. Events control us. And the daily life simply overwhelms us, and we get lost in it, and we complain, and we criticize, and we're full of pain and grief because life is so changeable, so disappointing, so full of futility. Collect yourself. Concentrate on the spirit, on, call it God if you want to, and some forms of Buddhism do, but on some oversoul of which we are a part. Well, Buddhism changed a great deal in China because it affected Chinese art, for instance. Confucius had no temples. Who would build a temple in Confucian philosophy? Buddhism is full of temples. You have Buddhas all over the Orient. Buddha, the founder of Buddhism, was not a god himself, but he came to be looked upon as an embodiment of the spirit of God in man, and men built these huge Buddhas, sometimes of silver and gold, and there were temples in which you came to reflect. Buddhism brought in a ministry. There were no clergy in Confucianism, but there's a whole Buddhist ministry or priesthood. The thought of a Buddha in regard to the body led to a revolution in art. You began to fashion the body, paint the body, whereas in Confucianism there had not been. Buddhism brings in a religious dimension into Chinese history. It affects painting, it affects art, architecture, the Buddhist temples, and it enriches Chinese life a great deal. Well,
I've gotten about a fourth of the way through what I hope to do today. We'll have to stop. Our time is up. But in this period of the six dynasties, back around 400 or 500, you get this introduction of Buddhism, which changes the life of China. Just this final note today, may we expect in a China which has become secular, materialistic, where all the emphasis is on government control, that some spiritual movement again may change the Chinese people? It did so 1500 years ago. One thing is true, Buddhism, that there is change, and the communist China today is not going to stay forever. Does the past, in a sense, throw a shadow as to what might be the future? Well, I want to go on with these other dynasties tomorrow, at least in a sketchy way, before we come down to our own time.